Don't say quatre leçons. And I do mean that. I thank you very much for allowing me to speak in English and being so kind to come. And now I have a medal as well, so the trip is complete. It has been a great honor. We have a lot to do today, so I think we should get started right away. As I mentioned in my opening remarks, we're interested today in what I'm calling the interfaces between glyptic art that we've been looking at from Persepolis and monumental art in the early Achaemenid period, that is mainly the time of Darius. We're also interested today in trying to articulate what are the qualities that are specific to the glyptic repertoire. So we're looking then both at the interfaces with monumental relief and also at this at the things that are distinct as to the glyptic images. As I mentioned also, this is a very large topic, and I am today not going to be able to cover this in any kind of detail at all. I hope to be able to show today by a couple of examples what I would call pathways or avenues of research that can be opened up or that will be opened up by this material from the fortification archive. And as in all of the previous lessons, I'm not going to try to impose a monolithic reading either on monumental sculpture or the glyptic evidence. Now, before we begin, I wanted to pose for you today a question of method. And it's a question that probably many of you were asking yourselves after the second and the third lectures. And I thought I would start by showing this seal. I don't have a drawing of this seal. We only found this seal, or it was only discovered a month ago. So it shows you again the nature of the discoveries that are still to be made. Oh, yeah, I don't know. Can we turn down the... Oh, I can do it here? I'll let you do this, lest I shut the whole system down. Okay, is it better? As I said, we just found this seal. Actually, Walter Hinckelmann found it as he's reading this text. I haven't seen it yet. It was one of the texts that Halleck had read but hadn't published. These are two shots of the same surface. The seal is rolled once here and once there. Once here. So this is the same tablet. I think you can see it's a remarkable design. There's an archer. There's the quiver and arrows with the tassel hanging down. Here's the bow. You're catching more of the bow here. He's shooting. He's let go one, two, three, maybe four arrows already towards a figure who appears to be running towards him, perhaps wearing some kind of pointed hat and carrying a spear. Here's his spear here. This is the archer. Here you can see a bit more of the back of the archer. Now, I show you this because, as you know, these scenes of combat or warfare are exceptionally rare in the whole of the Achaemenid period. And this is the first seal out of over 2,000 seals that we have from the archive that show a scene of warfare. And this is a very, very rare scene. And of course, one thinks immediately of Bisitun, because Bisitun is a very rare scene itself. It doesn't, of course, show warfare. It shows the aftermath of warfare. And the seal here and Bisitun share this kind of narrative quality, which, again, is a fairly rare thing in early Achaemenid art as a whole. Now, what I've just done here is I've enlarged this image, which, in fact, this object is no bigger than the palm of my hand. I've made it this big to look at, and I've taken the relief of Darius, which is not quite life-size. The figures are not as tall as we are. They're just a little bit under life size. And I've shrunk it down so that essentially what I've done is I've made these things visually comparable for us. And I think it's a question we really need to ask ourselves is that how valid is this to do? I mean, how reliable is it to juxtapose these little seal designs and then large monumental relief, which is one of the things I'm going to try to do today. In fact, I'm not the only person to have asked this question. Irene Winter posed it quite eloquently in an article that was published several years ago now about the difficulties of transposing, of the difficulties of looking at glyptic and monumental art, given the variables in the function of these images, the audiences for these images, and their social context. And in particular, she highlights what I just did. That is, I blew up the seal image, and I shrunk the monumental image so that we could sort of look at them together. And this elision of scale is, I think, an issue that we have to talk about. So too is the differences of function between glyptic and monumental relief. Thus, she concludes that seals could have had a quite different goals as well as audiences in their visual display, you know, however related those images may be. This is an important question, and we must not lose sight of this elision of scale that I have been doing over the course of the last four lectures, and also be aware that glyptic images in particular may have multiple levels of significance. Now, I think that what to get to the heart of this matter, we really have to look at the audience. That is, if we can establish that the audiences for glyptic and monumental relief were similar audiences, then I think we will have overcome the potential problem posed by the differences in scale. And of course, because we are embedded in this archive, we are very fortunate in knowing exactly who the audience was for the glyptic images. That is, it's the administrators who are using these seals. And in several cases, in fact, many cases, we've actually got some biographical detail about those people, both from the archive and also from other historical sources where they are mentioned. So the audience for our glyptic images included the people who are using the seals, obviously. They would have known about these images that they were using. They would include the individuals also who would see the seal in the processing of the documentation. It could be multiple individuals who would have seen the seals. Also, individuals who would have come in contact with these administrators by shared administrative responsibilities or shared social contexts as well, as much as we are able to glean from the text and also from inferences. I think all of these things then ensure for us, right, that that the audience for these images shared time and space. And that is absolutely critical for the types of analysis that we are trying to do here today. So that I think that we can say with some degree of certainty that these individuals moved in the region of Persepolis at the same time and they interacted with each other in bureaucratic and, I would add, social context as well. This really makes our job much easier now that we can say this and the types of conclusions that we can draw from the images themselves. I think that we can say again without any hesitation that many people who are using seals in this environment are exceptionally well versed in the protocols of court. Many of them were members of the elite in the region of Persepolis, and probably a handful of them actually would have encountered the king at some point in their lives. Certainly, those on the JTEX, I think, are pretty clearly would have. These individuals must have had a deep understanding and knowledge of the monumental reliefs at Nakshi Rustam and Persepolis, not only because they're members of this elitic court, and perhaps in some cases may have even participated in some of the planning for those reliefs, but because in many cases we know that some of these individuals are actually assigning rations to work groups who are responsible for the construction of the buildings and the reliefs. And so here I would include both Nakshi Rustam and the Apadana and the palace of Darius. And of course, by moving in the region of Persepolis, they would have been eyewitness to the carving of those reliefs and the construction of those buildings. This audience, I would pose to you, had the necessary knowledge, and indeed they would have been predisposed to make the kinds of associations between media and across scale that we are attempting to do here today. So I hope that that because of all of these things, you will allow me then to try to make some of these connections between monumental relief and glyptic. Now, just to get us started here, let me go through really quickly monumental relief from Cyrus and Darius. All of you will know this, but it'll just—it's always good to hear what you know, or at least I always like to hear what I know. It makes me feel good. Bisitun we'll be looking at, and of course Pasargadae and Persepolis and Nakshi Rustam. A plan, of course, of Pasargadae. Again, I'm not going to say anything of much import about this, only just to review this material for you. The main monumental buildings are in this area right here. Now, this is a detail of it, the Tomb of Cyrus. We're going to be looking at Gate R and Palace S. There's other sculpture on the site, but these are the main ones that I'll be concerned with here today. Gate R, I think, of all the buildings at Pasargadae, is the most interesting. This is a view looking at it with the famous winged genius here. Here's a plan of the building with the location of that genius. I've oriented the building here to be on the view that you've just seen here. So you're looking through this doorway here, and then this, you're looking through it here as well. Now, Hertzfeld found, you may remember, evidence, he said, for winged bulls on this doorway and winged human-headed bulls over here, although Stronach did not find any evidence of that in his excavations. Here are the drawings and photograph published by Stronach of the winged genie. Now, a lot has been said about this thing, and despite all of the kind of oddities of both its iconography and its style, this is an image that is deeply, deeply rooted in Assyrian traditions. And of course, this has been recognized for many, many years now. This is the winged genie from Khorsabad, which shows multiple stylistic connections to the winged genius at Pasargadae. And of course, the winged bulls and the winged human-headed bulls would have been another Assyrianizing element in the structure as well. Now, what's not often discussed, and I think is very interesting, is that the winged genius faces into the structure. Now, that's not really an Assyrian dynamic. Normally, these doorway figures face outward. Now, there are some examples where doorway figures in Assyrian art face inward, but for the most part, they face outward. I would posit to you then probably in this lost doorway over here, there were another set of figures that also faced inward. I do not think they would have been winged genii. If you're looking for where there would have been a representation of Cyrus, I posit that they probably were right here, so that you would have had Cyrus looking inward here and the winged genie looking inward here, so that then you've got a space that's highly charged right here in the center of this thing. And then, of course, the winged bulls are facing outward. So you've got this really very powerful dynamic of both inward focus and outward focus, a very, I would say, very imperial sort of visual dynamic going on there. Here is Palace S. Again, the four doorways show sculpture. I'm just interested in these two here because these probably are later there. Again, very Assyrianizing figures here. These are off of this doorway, and this is a quotation drawing off of this doorway. This particular combination of a taloned figure followed led by a human figure is documented in, this is the Southwest Palace. Here's the fish-robed individual. This is a drawing from one of the lost reliefs of the Southwest Palace at Nineveh. There is not in Assyrian art this syntax of a bull man, probably, and the fish man. But nonetheless, again, highly charged, highly Assyrianizing imagery. Of course, Bisitun, early in the reign of Darius, the location of the text, this is all known to you, and we'll be talking a little bit more about some of the dynamics of this relief. But really, I'm only going to hint at some of the possibilities because really, I think a thorough reanalysis needs to be done based upon the material now that we have from Persepolis. Of course, it's long been recognized that Bisitun has lots of connections, again, to Assyrian monumental sculpture. Here, a passage of the Elamite captives from the Southwest Palace at Nineveh. And again, the Assyrian king here and captives being back here being led toward him. Not exactly the same thing that we see at Bisitun, but the same kind of idea. And of course, many commentators have noted a great deal of similarity in the layout with the relief of Anubanini at Sari Pul, which is nearby Bisitun. We'll come back and say a little bit more about that. This is a detail of the head of Darius, and this is Ashurbanipal from the North Palace. And everyone just kind of glibly says, well, there's a lots of a stylistic similarity, but I mean, if you look, it is remarkable. Look, for instance, the eye, the treatment of the eyes are almost exactly similar, so too the eyebrow. Note also the way the upper part of the ear goes into the inner part here is exactly the same here. The treatment of the beards and the hair, exactly the same. Look even how his mustache comes down and comes into a curl here, exactly as it does with Ashurbanipal. I mean, this is not just references. I mean, this is almost as if they're copying Assyrian monumental relief when you get down to that level of detail. And we'll talk a little bit more about this garment that Darius wears in the pose here in just a minute. And then to finish up, just to get us started here with Nanxirustam and Persepolis, we've talked a lot about Nanxirustam in the last two lectures, so I won't say anything more about it right here. Persepolis, remember, not as much sculpture as one sees on the site today at the time of Darius. You've got the construction of the stairways going on the Apadana, and you would have also the doorways and the south stairway in the palace of Darius. Again, this is the north facade of the Apadana. Remember that central panel was replaced later. This is a drawing of the so-called treasury panels that were found in the treasury. One thing also, this drawing gets published a lot. This is fantasy up here. There's absolutely no evidence for a winged figure up above these, although it's almost always published without any kind of commentary at all. And the south facade of the Palace of Darius. We're going to talk a little bit more about this because there's some interesting connections with Persepolis and Glyptic and one of the doorway figures from the Palace of Darius. Now, what we can say about the Achaemenid monumental relief after Bisitun, so I'm setting Bisitun aside for the moment, is that these reliefs share a syntax, a vocabulary, a style of carving, and a decorum. All of these, Nanxirustam and Persepolis, are very similar, and I won't go into a detailed analysis of that because that's been done before. So too, they share a semantic, that is, the idea of kingship rather than a particular king, concepts of control and order, and then the harmonious interaction of the king and the subject peoples. Okay, with that background in mind, let's turn now for the rest of the lecture to the glyptic evidence from Persepolis. Just a reminder, the treasury archive found here in the treasury building, actually in these rooms right through here, dated 492 to 458, and then the fortification archive down here, 509 to 493. We're going to be talking both about material from the Treasury Archive and the Fortification Archive here today. Now, I think that the easiest way to kind of make this connection is to look at these groups of seals, seven in total that we have, that carry a royal name of Darius. These are the so-called royal name seals in Persepolitan Glyptic. And I think that these seals are direct glyptic analogs to what we see at Naqsh-e Rustam and Persepolis for several reasons that I'll talk about. First of all, the appearance of the royal name inscription surely must relate directly to the appearance of inscriptions on the Palace of Darius and also at Naqsh-e Rustam and Bisitun. In other words, official Achaemenid imagery almost always is accompanied by text. And this, again, is a very Assyrian phenomenon as well. As I mentioned, we've got four of these royal name seals from Darius in the Treasury Archive and four in the Fortification Archive and three in the Treasury Archive. Actually, one of the seals from the Treasury Archive also occurs in the Fortification Archive also occurs in the Treasury Archive. I'll just run through these seals. We've seen a couple of them, but it's good to sort of look at them all together here. Of course, we looked at seal 11, which belonged to Zishawish, and this is seal 7. This is that seal that occurs on these transactions that are qualified as dispensed or poured out before the king, cereals and grain. This is an individual that I've argued, or this office I've argued, actually travels with the king to prepare food for the king's party. Not everyone agrees with that. This is the seal that occurs in both the fortification and the treasury archive. Halleck gave it the number 113, in the treasury archive it's 4. It belongs to Barad Kama, who addresses letters in the Treasury Archive, and then he goes on and actually becomes the treasurer at Persepolis in the Treasury Archive. This seal is less well known. It's only really been published once in the synthesis that Pierre Briand recently published on the Fortification Archive. And it's a wonderful heroic encounter. It occurs, by the way, this one occurs only on the uninscribed tablets from the archive. And now here are the seals from the Treasury Archive. Now, these seals have been published for over 40 years. Right? In other words, this material there's been lots of time for people to make use of this material from the Treasury Archive, but almost nothing has been written about these seals from the Treasury Archive. I think one of the reasons, and I may have mentioned this to you in one of the earlier lectures, is that no drawings have ever been made. And so to look at the Schmidt's publication, just of the photographs, it's really hard to see sometimes what exactly is going on. I have made drawings of all the seals of the royal name seals of Darius. I'm working on those of Xerxes, and eventually we'll republish these because I think hopefully they'll make them more useful for individuals. So this is seal 1 and 2 belonging to these addressers from the Treasury Archive, and this one, Uratinda, seal number 3 from the Treasury Archive. Now, probably not surprisingly, these seals, royal name seals, share syntax, vocabulary, style, and decorum. Now, let me just talk a little bit more about some of these things. These royal name seals prefer three-figure compositions, that is, three verticals. I don't count the date palms. I'm talking about the figural designs here. They like these three-figure compositions. They like this V-shaped design. It seems to be, you can't really see it here, it's less so here. It seems to be very strong in seal 113 here. Now, of course, vocabulary, all of them have date palms. All of the royal name seals of Darius have date palms. Many of them have the figure in the winged disc. They all, with one exception, have crowns and in the so-called Persian court robe. And of course, all of them carry the royal name inscriptions. They all share a style, that is this court style. We talked about this in in our second lecture, so I won't go into any more detail about that. And they share a decorum, that is kind of an atmosphere, that is, they're very calm, they're very quiet, very static, despite the fact that you've got these, what seem to be rather active, heroic encounters, they're in fact very quiet. Now, the first thing I think that one can remark is that these royal name seals do not equate literally to anything in monumental sculpture. In other words, there's not a one-to-one connection between royal name seals and monumental sculpture from Persepolis or Nanxi-Rustam. However, there are some shared compositional elements. For instance, in the main figural groups, very often in monumental sculpture, we get these three-figure groups like you see here. We've talked a little bit about that. Also, this emphasis on a heavy emphasis on verticals is something that is shared between glyptic and monumental relief. We've seen also this kind of triangular device, compositional device that they like to use to anchor these scenes. And of course, they share lots of vocabulary, dentate crowns, Persian court robe, the figures in the winged disc. And as I mentioned to you, however, date palms are exclusive to the glyptic. And I think in broad terms, they are very similar stylistically, although I won't go into that today because that would take us a little bit off topic. And again, I think they share a decorum, that is these very quiet, calm release. It's also very interesting and I think important, I've mentioned it several times, that we've got these inscriptions that accompany both monumental relief and these royal name seals. And it's not simply the presence of the inscriptions, but it's the very tone of the inscriptions. Now, of course, these are very simple, I, Darius, king. But in many ways, I think one could make the argument that these are exceptionally condensed versions of monumental sculpture, both at Bisi-Tun and Nanxi-Rustam. And that is, they are first-hand, first-person declarative statements, which is essentially what we're getting both at Nanxi-Rustam and at Bisi-Tun. Now, we saw in the second lesson that these two seals, 11 and 7, are the earliest dated occurrences of these royal name seals, and they both occur in 502, 501. And we talked a little bit, or I talked a little bit, about some of the scenarios, possible scenarios that may explain the circumstances for the arrival of those seals in the late 6th century. Again, I won't go into any detail on those today. Now, there's one seal that, to my eye, seems different. One of the royal name seals seems very different from all of the others. And indeed, I am going to suggest to you that this treasury seal number one may, in fact, be the earliest of the royal name seals for reasons that I'll try to articulate. Now, I've chosen this knot seal not only because I think it's a very interesting seal, but it's an example of now the things that we can do with the material from the treasury archive that we couldn't do because we didn't have any kind of context for those seals. Now we have a context, that is, these over 2,000 seals from the fortification archive. So what I'm going to attempt to do today is to use this seal one as a vehicle to kind of go out and look at some things, to connect it to some things in the fortification archive as a way to understand and perhaps learn a bit more about the nature of its development and perhaps some of the meaning that is embedded, the semantic that's embedded in it as well. Now, it's a little bit different because I think there's less of an emphasis on the vertical in this seal one. Certainly by the inclination of the winged creature here, although there is a strong kind of sense of verticality, that's broken up a little bit. And so, too, we've got more of a squarish compositional group rather than a rectangular one over here. Now, what's even more interesting is that there's lots of differences in vocabulary between seal one from the treasury and the other royal name seals from the fortification fortification and treasury archive. First of all, the rendering of the garment is very different. We'll talk a little bit more about that. This figure absolutely does not wear a crown. I can definitively say that based upon the impressions that I've seen in Chicago. Not only that, the figure carries this very archaic-looking weapon here, which is quite unusual. I do not think that there is enough room up here for a winged symbol, although, again, we don't actually have the top of the seal in any impression, so I can't say that definitively. But all of these things make it, to my mind, stand out. So, too, it's carved in a very different kind of style. It's really much more of a modeled style, sort of miniature segmented style of carving. We'll look a little bit at that as well. And so, too, I think that this decorum of calm and restraint is broken a little bit, both by the inclination of the figure here, and also by this very active movement of the royal figure who lifts his leg forward. I think this really changes the dynamic that we see in these other royal name seals. Now, probably many of you have already said, well, in fact, a lot of these observations seem very similar to what we're seeing at Bissy Tun. And in fact, of course, the pose of Darius is exactly the same as the pose, except we're seeing the frontal chest rather than the profile at Bissy Tun. So too, the rendering of the garment, about which there's been a lot of discussion, I think is exactly the same at least the lower part of it is exactly the same. This is another reason why I think this seal is probably the earliest in the surviving sequence that we have. Not only that, this seal is deeply embedded, I think, in various carving traditions and iconographies that are found in the fortification archive, and especially with this group of archaizing seals that are deeply related to Assyro-Babylonian glyptic. And this, I guess, has been, of course, one of the recurring themes in the lectures, this deep entrenchment that Persepolitan glyptic has to both Babylonian, but really, I think, primarily Assyrian visual traditions. I've written a little bit about this, what I think must be a workshop of seals that produce these really dynamic scenes. This is one example from Volume 1 of A Hero. They're carved in this really interesting modeled style of carving, very segmented, big puffy shoulders that you see there. The heroes on these seals very often raise their forward leg, like we see on seal one here. They wear these elaborate fringed garments, such as you see here on seal 98. Note that on this treasury seal one, without a doubt, there is fringing that is running between the legs of the royal hero here. Again, a very rare thing to see on a royal, a figure who has these sort of royal associations. Just to highlight it there for you. Here's another one of these seals from this group that shows this very distinctive pose of reaching out and the leg placed on the creature. Another one of them as well. These seals also oftentimes include very archaic looking weapons. Look at this thing. It's some kind of axe or something that has a little thing coming off of it here. It's not the same thing, but it's just this these very old-fashioned looking weapons that both of them carry. Really, it's fairly closely related to the first seal of Parnaka, that is the weapon. I'll bring up a detail of it here. He also has one of these hooked devices. And I didn't bring in any examples, but these things are found very often in Assyro-Babylonian glyptic, this type of weapon. Another interesting thing about this group of seals that I've highlighted for you is the very high percentage of inscriptions. That is, if you look at this particular workshop, or even if you bring in all of these very dynamic compositional types, you're going to find at least 50% or more of them will carry inscriptions, which I think, again, is deeply related to the appearance of the inscriptions on these royal name seals. And there's also in Treasury Seal 1 a stylistic similarity in this kind of segmentation of carving. Note how there's a separate passage at the chest of the figure here, and how very often each little element is distinct, heavy use of the running drill and how volumes tend to swell. So again, I think directly related stylistically to this group. Anyway, the importance of all of these connections is that I think that we can see very directly some of the ways that at least in Seal One here, the artists and patrons have adapted and adopted a visual language from the Assyro-Babylonian period in this very formative phase of the in the early years of Darius. And hopefully we may be able to see something of this as we begin to turn to monumental sculpture as well. Now, another interesting thing about Seal One, which again has never been discussed, is the fact that this distinctive use of these human-headed, winged creatures that the figures stand upon. Now, I've made up a term to describe these creatures just as a shorthand way. I call them pedestal creatures. That is, they act as pedestals for figures to stand upon. And what's interesting is that not only is this a feature of Seal One, it's a feature of Seal 18, Royal Name Seal, and it's a feature of Treasury Seal 3. So that of the seven Royal Name Seals, no less than three of them employ these pedestal creatures. This to me seems to be a really important thing, and I'd like to know a little bit more about the significance of this particular type of imagery. So again, we can use the fortification archive for this. Now, what is also interesting about these pedestal creatures is that, again, there's no exact equivalent in monumental sculpture. However, I will try to suggest some possible analogs in monumental sculpture as well. Now, pedestal creatures are not very common in Persepolitan glyptic, that is, in the material from the fortification archive. Although we do have a goodly number of them, it's not like we have only a handful. They tend to occur as this 1567, which is the seal of Ashpazana. This is, as I mentioned to you in a previous lecture, this is, I think, the very Ashpazana, the one mentioned at Nongshi Rustam. It's, again, a very archaizing image carved in this modeled style of carving. Here's another example of a heroic encounter where there are these pedestal creatures, again, carved in this modeled style. Note, both of them have inscriptions as well. So that here's another interesting thing. If you collect together all of the scenes that have this distinctive modeled style of carving, they're going to have a high percentage of inscriptions. Then if you collect together all the scenes that show pedestal creatures, they also have a very high percentage of inscriptions. I don't think that this is just by chance that we're seeing these kinds of predilections. Now, if we turn to semantics just for a second, these, what I'm calling pedestal creatures, of course, have a long tradition in the art of Assyria and Babylonia. And their significance is unambiguous. They are signifiers of the divine or the supernatural. Right? Gods, such as this famous one from the British Museum, where it shows Ishtar standing on the back of this lion. They can be deities, or they can be just kind of give the idea of supernatural. Now, what I'd like to do as a way to try to context a little bit more the use of these pedestal creatures and to see a little bit more about what's going on in Seal 1 is to select for you today a handful of seals that also are using pedestal imagery that I think represent early formative phases of what we could call a court-centered art. And I want to distinguish an art that is attempting to articulate concepts of the kingship versus the court style, which is, of course, doing that, but has a very specific meaning. I start with a remarkable seal, Seal 389. The pedestal creatures here are these fishmen. They're winged fishmen. But the focus of their attention is, in fact, an inscription above which there is a winged disc. And then there's a figure who wears a crown here, holds a flower, and I think is wearing the court robe. It's a wonderful example of what I would characterize as sort of a hybrid seal. A seal that is showing lots of Assyrian characteristics and also lots of I shouldn't have said court style here, but court-centric imagery. Now, the seal, again, is sculpted in this very distinctive modeled style, very small modeled style of carving, lots of use of running drill. Alas, this is a horrible photograph. The seal does not photograph very well. But again, that's an Assyro-Babylonian heritage. Of course, the fishmen here as well are a heritage from Assyrian glyptic. And as I mentioned to you, I think that the robe that the figure wears is the Persian court robe. And of course, the winged disc, the flower, and the dentate crown. What I've articulated here is that these are sort of specific to Achaemenid court art. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, that the winged disc doesn't occur in other contexts. Of course, it's a heritage itself from Assyro-Babylonian glyptic, mainly Assyrian glyptic, but it's the combination of court robe, winged figure, and dentate crown, which I think is a specific aspect of the of what we could call court art. Note also the equilibrium. One, two, really three major verticals. This throws it off just a little bit, which I think is, again, a specifically Achaemenid court thing. And then, of course, the syntax. That by the syntax, I mean taking the how are the various vocabulary elements put together so that the center focus is the inscription, winged disc above, and then attendance to other side is deeply related to what we see at Persepolis. You may recall, of course, the southern facade of the Palace of Darius. This is Crefter's reconstruction of it, where we have exact or very similar kind of dynamic, don't we? Inscription panel, winged disc, attendance to either side. In other words, this seal is reflecting for us a predilection to a type of dynamic that I think is kind of, that is court or royal related. I'll come back and talk a little bit more about that southern facade with another seal as well. Here is just a remarkable design that is from the uninscribed tablets, which as you can see is very similar, isn't it? We've got the fish creatures, but look what's happened in this one. Here the inscription is in the center. Now the inscription has been flipped over here. It's at the back end of the thing, and it's replaced with the figure in the winged disc and the so-called sacred tree, which again then turns this into a very Assyrianizing scene. In other words, this to me, I would argue, has developed out of this type of scene. Here we're looking at early formative stages of a court of expressions of court art that are developing out of these kinds of designs. And this is just a remarkable seal, isn't it? This is one impression of it. We've got a better impression. I didn't have a photograph of it. But again, it shows this hybrid quality. Some elements of the Achaemenid of sort of court elements, but this one is exceptionally embedded in the Assyro-Babylonian tradition, that is especially its syntax here. You'll remember this is B23, that important slab from the palace of Ashurnasirpal II at Nimrud, where we have that same syntax, winged figure, sacred tree, and then attendance to either side, probably royal attendance such as you see. Note you've even got the same number, two attendants over here and two attendants over here, just really remarkable, and of course the presence of inscriptions. And then look at this this really interesting design, which I think is directly analogous to the types of formations that we're seeing in 389. So another beautiful example of a hybrid. This time these pedestal creatures, and again the theme that's connecting all of this are these pedestal creatures. In other words, I'm using these pedestal creatures as an avenue to try to explore some of the visual dynamic of that Treasury Seal 1. And again, it's the style of carving is in that Persepolitan modeled style. The garments here are Assyrian. The Aramaic inscription, I would relate that to a specifically Persian glyptic context, Achaemenid glyptic context. Of course, Aramaic inscriptions occur on Assyrian seals and Babylonian seals as well. However, whatever these are, whether they're spears or some kind of staffs, I think these and the winged symbol here, these have specific court associations. So too, one, two, three vertical composition as well. And the syntax here, that is the winged figure with the attendants on either side, again, are specifically, I think, Achaemenid court related. Here again, the south facade. Now, in the other one, we had the inscription panel in the previous seal. Now we've got the winged disc that's been moved down here, attendants to either side, who are holding spears. So, I mean, here we've even got that detail of vocabulary. And I always wonder whether the human-headed creatures here are, in fact, part of this process of translation that is going on in monumental relief. In other words, that these are equating to these pedestal creatures down here, the spearmen on either side there and the winged figure. And then here's another very interesting seal that uses these pedestal creatures that again seems to be really early in the formation of an expression of concepts of kingship. The pedestal creature has been really highly reduced here so that it's just underneath the winged figure, and it's these adorsed probably horned lions. Now, the style of carving here is the local fortification style, which is interesting. Note that we've got the Achaemenid court garments here. We've also got the winged symbol, which again is association with the court. But what really makes this seal stand out, of course, is that the figure in the winged symbol here is handing a ring to this figure who reaches out and grabs it. Now that is both an Assyrian, Assyro-Babylonian, and indeed goes back into earlier periods as well, heritage. But also, of course, you'll remember that the winged figure at Bisitun holds a ring. So too at Sarai-Pul, Ishtar holds a ring that she offers out. Even Anu Banini doesn't actually reach out and grab it as this one. And just to remind you also that this is a tradition in Syrian monumental art, you can probably just make out the ring that the figure in the winged disc is holding there. But in Assyrian glyptic, especially these wonderful drilled and modeled style of seals, very often you get a female deity in a nimbus here, and she holds a ring that the person actually reaches out almost to touch, which seems closer to what we have here. The irregular kind of composition, we've got three figures here, that is, so I think very similar to what we've been seeing over here, but the syntax is irregular. That is, we've got this rampant animal over here rather than another one of these figures, which sort of throws the thing off a little bit, that is, as regards syntax. I think this is probably, again, a thing specifically related, a phenomenon specifically of glyptic. Now, I want to sort of, the last sort of things I want to look at here are a pedestal scene that shows an archer on it, because it relates us to yet another important theme that is connected to these pedestal creatures, and that is these archers. There probably is a pedestal for each of these guys. And again, we've got the same kinds of hybrid qualities, Persepolitan modeled style, Assyrian garments, probably a very balanced composition with the three verticals there. But again, the thing is thrown off just a little bit by the irregularity of the syntax. But then note the pose of the archer, how it's related to what we see over here, which again adds a dynamic to the scene, and also kind of makes these pedestal creatures a little bit different. It's a different use of them. Again, I relate back to Darius's pose at Bisitun, and I think that this pose is coming out of this tradition. I mean, of course, Anu Banini holds his leg up there and steps on the thing, but I think that these pose of archers also must be another tradition that is that this particular pose is relating to. This is an Assyrian scene here. Oftentimes, the archer in these Assyrian seals will put their leg on the back leg of the creature or on their hindquarters. This one doesn't show that. Here's a beautiful example of this kind of imagery, archer imagery, not a pedestal scene, but where the leg is uplifted. We've got, you know, these archer scenes are really important because they are, if you just sort of categorize all the scenes that show humans in them, the archers are the second most common after the heroic encounter. I mean, we've got almost 200 of these scenes that show archers from the archive. And here's this kind of running pose that is a very common one among these archer scenes as well. I think this is carved in the Persepolitan local style, that is the so-called fortification style. But note that you've got elements of court garments and the dentate crown here as well. I've talked a little bit about the irregular syntax that we have on this thing, which I think is very similar to the dynamic that we see in this, that the thing is thrown off a little bit in its dynamic. Now, these archer scenes raise a very interesting issue, and that is that these archers are always in the process of shooting, so that the archer imagery, as it were, is active rather than static. And that active use of archery, of course, is an Assyrian heritage, but I think is also clearly something that is deeply embedded in the material from the fortification. And I'd like to just share with you briefly, to kind of go off these pedestal creatures, to talk a little bit more about these archer scenes, because I think they are so important as, again, a kind of interface with monumental relief. This remarkable seal, 71, this is one of the few seals that overlaps with the Treasury Archive. That is, it occurs in both the Fortification Archive and the Treasury Archive. Again, this seal has been known for over 40 years. No one's ever said anything about it, but my gosh, it is a remarkable design on so many levels. The seal belongs to an Elamite, Irdu Martia. That's the name that occurs in the text. This is probably, I think, the very person who is mentioned in Bisitun as someone who is commanding an army. And note, this seal appears on tablets dated to 508, 507. This is like right at the beginning of the archive. This is, to my knowledge, the earliest occurrence of what we could call court-centered imagery that we have. Not the court style, but sort of court-centered imagery that is specifically in the use of the so-called Persian court robe and these the bow and the quiver. And just to go back, I mean, look at the beautiful, this is a big, massively modeled style of carving. I think you can see it even here. Very large volumes that are used in this thing. Now, of course, this hunt with the arrow of lions in particular would have deep Assyrian resonance owing to the release both at Nineveh, both at Nimrud, but especially at Nineveh, where the famous lion hunts of Ashurbanipal. But note even the pose, this remarkable design from Nineveh, where the Ashurbanipal is kneeling down and shooting, which is very similar to the type of thing that we see here. Note also these kind of freeform compositions. That is, that's one of the things that's so distinctive about those lion hunt reliefs of Ashurbanipal, is that use of space. And we're getting the same thing in this seal, aren't we, with these figures that are floating in space. So too, both Seal 71 and Assyrian Relief have this kind of cinematographic quality. I mean, you've all seen these, I know, where you get the lion, lion out of the cage, lion running, lion jumping, and being killed by the king. So too, probably the same sort of thing here and down here, lion carried in, lion dropped down, king pouring over it. We've got exactly the same thing here, right? Dead lion and rampant lion. Now, whether or not this is the same, like, are we to read this like a reel, that is, lion being shot and then lion dead, as perhaps we would have, or even just a dead lion in the field and then another one there? It doesn't matter. They're both heavily, both readings are available in the Assyrian evidence. And look especially at, see how the lion on its back with its legs up? Again, is almost a direct quotation from that passage. The paws on either side extended out, again, a convention that you see very often in Assyrian reliefs. And I remind you that the second seal of Parnaka also uses this convention in a rather Baroque fashion. It's interesting that these kinds of narrative, freeform scenes where you've got these figures in the field, are related to these famous heirloom seals. They show the exact same kind of dynamic, seal 93, and then the seal 51 that belongs to Ir Dabama. In other words, these are coming out of the same tradition. Now, these, of course, are earlier, and I've argued that they're 7th century, they're heirloom seals. Now, another interesting thing about these archers is that they're different from monumental relief in the sense that monumental relief only uses the bow as a static symbol, whereas, as I've mentioned to you, these scenes are very, very active. Again, we get both of these in the Assyrian evidence, that is both the active scene with the king shooting this from Nimrud this time, and then down here, the scenes where the bow is used passively or static as simply an emblematic, as an emblem rather than as a part of a kind of narrative description. Note also, what's interesting in monumental relief is that at Bisitum and Naqsh-e Rustam, the bow is always repeated. There seems to be this emphasis that it's got to be reiterated several times. Bow, reference to bow here, reference to bow here, and of course the reference in the text as well. This is just a detail of Gabrias and Ashpazana, whose seal we just saw a little bit earlier. And then isn't it interesting that we get both the active use of the bow and the passive use of the bow in the type 1 and type 2 derricks. Passive here, active here. In other words, this tradition, these two are coming out of the same tradition. And is it too much to say that the type 3 is a synthesis visually of types 1 and 2? That is, the active figure, but the bow used as an attribute rather than actually being pulled. And then I'll end this discussion of pedestal figures and archers with just a seal that is in many ways so dense in its visual imagery that it's really difficult to sort of encapsulate it all here in just a few minutes. This is seal 261 from the Treasury Archive, and as I say, it's a particularly dense synthesis of some of these ideas that we've been talking about. The seal does not photograph very well. It's always just applied in little short spurts, so really we have to use the drawing to see the whole thing. It is, again, a mixture of fortification and style, of fortification and court style. Now, the double verticals here, I think, are directly analogous to the type of dynamic that we see in seal 1. But note also, very interesting, the archer shoots a duck-headed bow, but there's also another bow on the back, as well as the quiver and the arrows. So here we can have it both ways. We've got the bow both as an active attribute and as a passive attribute, and it functions, I think, exactly the same way as we see at Naqsh-e Rustam, where we get the repetition of the bow, as we saw there. Now, of course, these scenes of the archer and the lion are not simply an inheritance from Assyro-Babylonian period, but they go deep into the famous Uruk stele here, and of course represented more recently in these lion hunts that we've seen. Now, what makes this scene even more remarkable is the fusion of the archer with the pedestal creature. And indeed, this thing appears to be drawing on two distinct kind of traditions. This is a composite winged bird and then a scorpion tail here. And there are lots of examples I could have brought in to show you these kinds of hybrid creatures, which are again associated with deities in Assyrian, and specifically the scorpion tail creature is often associated with Ninurta. But it's that three-quarter pose that seems to sort of be rising, or even just, I would say, fused into the pedestal creature that is so, I think, remarkable, drawing on the tradition both of the figure in the winged element, so here we have the wings, right, as well as this other tradition of standing on the pedestal creature. So it seems to be a combination of both of these ideas. And just to remind you, we saw in our lecture last time the use of this idea of a deity who's posed on the back of a creature in the material from Persepolis. This type of image, I think, will make us completely rethink the so-called figure in the winged disc. And I won't go into all of the details of that here. It also, I think, will make us think more carefully about this half figure on the Type 1 derricks. So we have a particularly dense reference to ancient ideas of killing of lions, to Achaemenid kingship, as well as to Assyro-Babylonian ideas of the divine and the supernatural. Now, again, these pedestal creatures, just to kind of summarize, do have some equivalence, I think, in monumental sculpture. Here we're getting now at the interfaces here. I think that in many ways these pedestal creatures function sort of conceptually in the same way as the peoples, the lands who hold up the crown, hold up the platform of Darius. So too, I think it's a remarkably striking visual parallel between the pedestal capitals here, which of course hold up the roof of the building, this really fanciful reconstruction that you can see here. I like that. And then, of course, the more direct analogy are the Gate of All Lands at Persepolis, where the bull, where the human-headed creatures are essentially holding up the walls in the same way that they function here. Here again, then, these pedestal creatures can bring with them can signify aspects of Achaemenid architecture, concepts of protection, as well as connections with imperial Assyrian architecture, and potentially even to mythological narratives as well. So what I've attempted to do here is to use these royal name seals as a springboard to look a little bit more closely at the imagery on these seals. What we saw was that they share some aspects of syntax and vocabulary with monumental sculpture. But the most important thing, I think, is that these royal name seals, in fact, are part of a much larger corpus, much richer corpus of glyptic imagery that is evolving, developing, and attempting to express concepts of Achaemenid kingship. This royal-centric glyptic, then, has these qualities, I think. Obviously, they show direct connections in style, vocabulary, and syntax with both royal imagery and divine imagery from the Assyrian period. And again, this connection with Bisitun, the strong Assyrianizing phenomenon that we see there, perhaps future research may allow us to understand a little bit better the dynamics of the evolution of this particular monument. These royal name seals also express a dynamic of royalty that has some correspondence, as we've seen, with monumental relief, but in many measures is completely independent from it. And I would posit to you that these images that we've been looking at here today, that they express a concept of kingship that shows a more direct association between the king and divine and the supernatural, or they are attempting to blur the distinction between the divine and the king. And so potentially these seals will be avenues of future exploration, not only on this expression of kingship in Persepolitan glyptic per se, but as we've seen, can potentially be brought to coinage, Bisitun, Nansi Rustam, and Persepolis. Thank you very much again. It's just been a wonderful series of lectures. I've enjoyed talking with you, and thank you for your patience.